evening. This is Terry in Colorado. My call sign's KI0RE. This is the NLA Hams Net, and we welcome anybody to participate. This net is conducted at 8 p.m. Eastern Time every Wednesday, and we're on for about 45 minutes. We are loosely conducting the net like an actual ham net, where people are supposed to go through a controller or a net control, if you will. But it's kind of relaxed since we're on a conference call and many people don't have a call sign. We've been going through the first part of this book about Wi-Fi networking in the developing world. You can find it at wndw.net. And you can actually read the book online, or you can download it, or you can send them some money. They'll send you a hard copy. But WNDW, Whiskey November Delta, whiskey.net, and click on the online book. Go down to Chapter 1, and we're on page 13. We left off, or page 12. We left off at the Huygens Principle from last week. So that's where I'm going to pick it up this week. Hopefully that's enough of a reset and everybody can get where we're going. Does anybody have any questions, announcements, comments, or anything else? Pitchforks, whatever you have. I'll open the floor right now for any of that. Well, hearing none. It talks about the Huygens Principle. That was named after Christian Huygens, a Dutch mathematician and physicist and astronomer, 1629 to 1695. And he talks about wave fronts, and that every front of a wave, if it stopped, and you say you just have a small slit, it creates, that has the potential of creating a new set of waves coming from that one position. The Huygens Principle is a method of analysis applied to problems of wave propagation in the far field limit. It recognizes that each point of an advancing wave front is in fact the center of a fresh disturbance and the source of a new train of waves, and that the advancing wave as a whole may be regarded as the sum of all the secondary waves arising from points and the medium already traversed. Has anybody got any questions? Okay, we'll continue on. And he talks about viewing it and taking a stick and put it in there, it'll help us understand the principle of diffraction as well as Fresnel zones and a whole bunch of other things. Great. Absorption. Another characteristic is that electromagnetic waves can be absorbed. They go through something, some material. They generally get weakened or dampened. I'm sorry, did somebody say something? Nope, it was outside my door. Never mind. Anybody's welcome to interrupt me at any time. How much they lose in power will depend on the frequency and, of course, the material. Clear window glass is obviously transparent for light, while the glass used in sunglasses filters out quite a share of the light intensity and most of the ultraviolet radiation. Often an absorption coefficient is used to describe a material's impact on radiation. For microwaves, the two main absorbent materials are metal. Electrons can flow freely in metals and are readily able to swing and thus absorb the energy of a passing wave. And water. Microwaves cause water molecules to jostle around, thus taking away some of the wave's energy. So that's what they're setting up for. They're getting you to get the idea that this is a wave that comes out of the antenna. I don't want to read it, but I certainly don't want to jump over anything that somebody needs to hear. For the purpose of practical wireless networking, we may well consider metal and water perfect absorbers. We will not be able to go through them. Although thin layers of water will let some power pass, they are to microwave what a brick wall is to light. And then he talks about different types of water, or they talk about it. All of those will have an effect on your radio link. So if you get up and you got a microwave link for whatever reason, and there's a lot of thick fog all the way around you, well, if there was a distance to your Wi-Fi network, it wasn't in your home, it was maybe, you know, a quarter mile away, you might have a problem getting to that because the water in the air, the moisture in the air will absorb a lot of that, and you might not have a strong enough signal, or the Wi-Fi might not have a strong enough signal to you. Realize that it goes back and forth both ways. There are other materials that have more complex effect on radio absorption. For trees and wood, the amount of absorption depends on how much water they contain. Old, dead, dry wood is more or less transparent. Wet, fresh wood will absorb a lot. Plastics and similar materials generally do not absorb a lot of radio energy, but this varies depending upon the frequency, type of material. And lastly, we'll talk about ourselves, humans, as well as other animals. That's because we're made out of water. As far as radio networking is concerned, we may well be described as a big bags of water with the same strong absorption. So it makes a difference where you're setting and where your antenna is. I've recently had a chance to demonstrate this. I moved to a new place. I could not have a hard line connection with an Ethernet cable down to the router, and I had to go with my with a Wi-Fi adapter plugged into a USB port. So I bought the adapter, I plugged it in the back of the computer, nothing. It didn't recognize it at all. I thought, oh, what's going on? Oh, maybe I need to get it out front. So I got a USB extension cable, pulled it out, and it's laying on the floor just to the front of and to the right of my desktop computer. Works great. Just getting it so that it's not surrounded by me, the metal in the desk, the computer, all of this stuff being between the router and my computer and its little antenna. So be thinking about it all the time. Now it talks about reflection. Like visible light, radio waves are reflected when they come in contact with materials that are suited for that. For radio waves, the main sources of reflection are metal and water surfaces. Good, good. The rules for reflection are quite simple. The angle at which a wave hits a surface is the same angle at which it gets deflected. So you draw, if you have a surface and you draw a line perpendicular, that's a normal point, and you have a signal coming in at a particular angle, and that's something that some people don't quite understand. Whatever angle it comes in at to the bottom of that, whatever the normal perpendicular line is, it's going to go back out at the same angle. Most of you saw this in high school or college and are kind of familiar with it. The incidence of light is the same when it bounces off. But one thing you have to consider is that we're not talking about just a surface. When radio waves propagate, they propagate out like the surface of a lake, but those waves are going up and down, and the up and down waves aren't necessarily as strong as the straight out perpendicular to the antenna waves. And so those wavefronts act a little bit differently, and they will bounce. Rules of radio. Okay. Note that in the eyes of a radio wave, a dense grid of bars acts just the same as a solid surface, as long as the distance between the bars is small compared to the wavelength. That's why you have little holes in the door of your microwave. To the radio waves inside your microwave, that looks like a metal plate. And that's kind of what it says in the next paragraph there. But because light is a little bit higher frequency, you can see in and watch your stuff cook and see how you've just driven all the butter you were melting for your popcorn all over your paper towel. I'm sure you were using a paper towel. Nobody ever puts anything in a microwave without something below it, right? Although the rules of reflection are quite simple, things can become very complicated when you imagine an office interior with many small things, and that's what I was talking about. The same goes for urban situations. Look around you in a city environment and try to spot all of the metal objects. Now they're going to talk about multipath. Oh, there's my diagram. On page 15, there's a diagram of incidence, theta I, which is incidence, and theta R, which is the reflected signal across a flat surface. Okay? Multipath is where you have various absorbers and reflectors, and as you travel some distance in along the ground or in space, however you want to look at it, some of those signals that are bouncing around get to you strongly at one point and then almost not at all at the next one. And so multipath is its own kind of idea. Sometimes the phase is out of whack. Sometimes the amplitude is out of whack, but the signal is reaching their target along different paths and therefore at different times. They play such an important role in wireless networking. They really do. Okay, any questions? Somebody has their mic open. If you're going to make noise, please R6 so that hear me, because I like to be heard. Thank you.
Okay. This is KC3HVA. Just a couple comments. Going back to when you were talking about absorption and the effect of weather, we at NLA delight in using Skype for all of our small conferences. And many times when there's been a storm front go through here, I use a little hotspot now, which is much better than what I used to use, which was a microwave tower across the valley. The little hotspot has four antennas, cell phone towers, within probably an 8-mile radius, and it picks the strongest and talks to it. Now, sometimes you'll begin to hear people kind of blank in and out. Some of the signal has been absorbed, but not all of it. Sometimes it'll just block out completely, and a second or two later, or a little longer, it'll come back on. So it'll be like they're off, they're on, they're off, they're on, as that front moves through. And as it moves away, it's back to normal. Everything sounds great. Now, another thing on the reflections, if anybody ever played pool or billiards, it's much the same as the ball striking the cushion or a wave striking the boundary, the metal or whatever you're bouncing off of. It comes off at the same angle that it hits at. So if you've ever played pool, it's the same sort of, not identical phenomenon, but it's a good analogy. Over.
Yeah, thank you, Jen. That's good information. I appreciate the enlightenment. You're absolutely right. Okay, and then it talks about parabolas and how they can focus the signal. That's why satellite dishes are curved slightly. What they're doing is they're trying to direct a whole bunch of those waves over a wide area. You can effectively consider, instead of receiving one little signal wherever your antenna is, you can effectively say, this whole little antenna, like a satellite antenna that's sitting on your house for DirecTV or EchoStar, that whole area of that antenna, every wave that hits there gets reflected towards that little bitty antenna on the arm in front of it. So you're taking a large area and you're concentrating those waves, and they all reinforce each other, and that gives you a little gain in the signal. Well, a microwave link, you do that too. So I won't go into that much more. Diffraction is the apparent bending of waves when hitting an object. Now, waves will refract off of a slit, like as on page 16. They'll refract off of a corner, because if you think of a corner, that's kind of like having half a slit. And they will reflect off of a single pole, even if you, like a wall, and you go over the other side of the wall, it will go down. Now, is the signal much less? Yes, it gets attenuated as it goes around that, but it's still there. So they talked about a solid barrier, and they cut a slit in the wall, and it continues on. The way they got it drawn there, a straight wavefront, by the time the wave gets really straight like that, it's gone for a long ways. So whatever the signal is, if you look at the signal, it's going to go through that wave. It's because it's being diffracted and it's opening up. Your signal strength starts going down at the inverse square root of the distance at where the slit is, and it wasn't very big when it got to the slit in the first place. So it does tend to reduce the signal strength at that point. Okay. And now they're talking about the Huygens principle provides one model for understanding this behavior. And they go in how to go it. The idea was later explained by Fresnel, and I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong, it's French. And whether it adequately describes phenomena is still quite a matter of debate. For our purposes, the Huygens model describes the effect quite well. And they're showing a little bit different there, potential spherical wavelets. Okay. It'll bend around buildings. Okay, on page 17, it talks about, well, the wave will go over an edge of that mountaintop and then bend over that edge of the mountain. Remember what I said about it looks like to the radio wave, half of a slit. So the part that's below that, it'll bend down. Does it bend down? Is there any loss of strength? You bet. There will be a great loss of strength for that signal to be picked up on the right-hand dish as opposed to being somewhere on the line on a higher hill further on where you got a direct sight to that antenna. Then we come to interference on page 17. It's one of the most misunderstood terms, and we talked a little bit about it before here. And interference often gets the blame when we are too lazy to find the real problem or when a regulator wants to shut down someone else's network for business reasons. So why all the misunderstanding? It's mostly because different people mean different things when they say interference. A physicist and a telecommunications engineer will use the word interference in very different ways. The physics view will be concerned with the behavior of waves. The telecommunications engineer will talk about any noise that gets in my way. So both views are relevant, and what they're talking about there on page 18 is you can see that the waves in the first diagram, they're a certain height, but they're in phase. And so your output wave is twice as high, and twice as low as either of the original waves. The bottom one is the same two waves, except the second one is the phase has been shifted. And because it goes down when the other goes up, they tend to cancel out each other. So the bottom is destructive interference. The top is constructive interference. And you hit little peaks and valleys just because it is the world. And oftentimes, if I can't hit a repeater, I'll move one-half wavelength or a quarter wavelength in some direction. And I will eventually find one that peaks. And it just so happens that wherever I was standing, it was a null spot like the destructive interference. I'm looking for the spot that has constructive interference. Is everybody with me on that?
Yes.
Absence of feedback besides Jan's. Yes, I know he's got it. Yes.
Just this KC3HVA again. I just want to go back for a minute to the diffraction through a slit. That's a real interesting problem. On one side of the barrier or the metal plate or whatever has a slit in it, the waves have been traveling for a long, long distance. They're in what they call the far field, where they're basically a straight line for whatever width of reflector or conductor you have, and it has a little tiny hole in it. So there's very little additional spreading loss as the wave is going on. Once it hits that hole, the only energy that it gets through goes through that little hole, and then it diffracts in a hemispherical pattern. So now the loss goes up dramatically. It goes up as 1 over r squared again. So as you go out in range, it decreases very, very rapidly. Now, you can play a lot of games with these if you have, like in acoustics, if you had a barrier that had two or three openings in it, you can form patterns because at some point in the far field, they will add up, like Terry was just saying, constructively, but maybe down the parallel to the plate, they'll all subtract, so they'll all go away. So you can make a nice lobe or a series of lobes to discriminate against different things with it. Over.
Oh, Jan, that was better than I do. Thank you very much.
Oh, no.
That's right. Okay, so we have constructive and destructive interference. You can make these work to your advantage. I gave one example where I couldn't hit a repeater. Well, I would move just a half to a quarter wavelength in one direction, or maybe I'd move two wavelengths in a different direction. And usually within a step or two, I can find a spot where there's constructive interference. How do I tell this? I watch my view meter that's telling me how strong the signal is from the repeater. And I move the antenna in the space that I occupy until I get the highest reading on that view meter. And then I don't move. I do the rest of my talking or communicating right there. So when I key up, I assume that all of the things that happen when my signal leaves here are going to lead to constructive interference at the antenna site for the repeater. And thus, I will have the strongest signal and everybody will be able to hear me. Does it always work? No. But as a ham radio operator, you want to be able to try things. You want to experiment and see what works and what doesn't. And you want to have all these things, you want to work with it a little bit and have all these things in your head. Well, I could do this. I could move to a different place. I could move to a higher spot. I could move away from this building, which I think is not helping me. All these different things. Okay. Now they talk about antenna 1, 2, and 3. I haven't gone over that. I'm not worried about it. I think everybody should read it. There's nothing really difficult in there. If anybody has any questions, speak now. And then we get to the term line of sight, often abbreviated LOS. Now be careful, because NASA likes to call LOS a loss of signal, which that means there's two definitions. And in programming terms, that means that LOS is overloaded. It means two different things. It's quite easy to understand when talking about visible light. If we can see point B from point A where we are, we have a line of sight. Simply draw a line from A to B. So if there's nothing in the way, we have a line of sight. Google or some of the other software, you now can pick two places, and it will show you the elevation profile of your line. And if there's a great big mountain in between you, well, there you go. It's going to be difficult to get through that dirt and rock. If there isn't anything and it's all bop, 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 well, even if you can't see it because you don't know exactly where to look, you're probably going to hit it. Things get a little bit more complicated when they are dealing with microwaves. Remember, the most propagation characteristic of electromagnetic waves scale with their wavelength. This is also the case for widening of waves as they travel. Light has a wavelength of about 0.5 micrometers. Microwave, as used in wireless networking, have a wavelength of a few centimeters. Well, that's quite a big difference. If you imagine a few centimeters, I think there's 2.54 centimeters per inch. So a 3-inch thing will have about a 7 or 8 centimeter length. Consequently, their beams are a lot wider. They need more space, so to speak. Note that visible light beams widen just the same. And if you let them travel long enough, you can see the results despite the short wavelength. When pointing a well-focused laser at the moon, its beam will widen to well over 100 meters in radius by the time it reaches the surface. You can see this effect for yourself using an inexpensive laser pointer and a pair of binoculars on a clear night. And that's fun to do. Just don't point it up at the sky where you might hit a pilot or something. Really, really neat. But what it's saying is that everything is going to spread out, and you might not have enough signal left, even though you can see the other one. I have found that generally, if you can see the object, you can talk to it. If you can see the other antenna, even if you can't actually see it, but you know it's on that hill right over there, you just can't see it. You get a pair of binoculars, you can see it. That will work. Line of sight that we need in order to have an optimal wireless connection from A to B is more than just a thin line. Its shape is more like that of a cigar, an ellipsoid. Its width can be described by the concept of Fresnel zones. Again, that's why they introduced Fresnel or Fresnel zones. See you next section for explanation. Thank you. You also find an abbreviation, non-line of sight, which is mostly used to describe and advertise technologies that allow for dealing with waves that reach the receiver through multiple trajectories, multipath or diffraction. It does not include the single electromagnetic beam goes around corners. Other than through diffraction or through obstacles, any better than any of the other technologies. For example, you might call white space technology NOS, as its lower frequency, longer wavelength will allow it to permeate objects and utilize diffraction much better than comparable 2.4 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz transmission. And then it talks about the understanding of Fresnel zone. If you look on page 21, it shows you what they're talking about. You see the cigar shape between the two antennas? What they're saying is that because of the law that Fresnel postulated, even though you can see directly across the antenna, your microwave radiation takes a little more space than what line of sight does. And because of that, that little partial obstruction may have quite a bit of an effect. Might not affect it at all. It depends on how big that Fresnel radius is and how far away you are from the obstacle and the other antenna. And then it goes down through and gives you some math. Now, I don't want to... worry too much about the math, but if you go through it, it's not as hard as it looks. Any questions? If you were actually going to establish a wireless network for a developing world, you really ought to do this and see if you got enough room to get up to there. And it'll take care of it.
Question.
Yes, sir.
Do you ever get obstacles that are large enough that they will reflect back right at the transceiver that sent them and be able to distinguish them, whereas the travel time's so short that it's all yucked up in the transmission?
You do get things that are big enough to reflect. And as a matter of fact, that could have a large bearing on my example before, where I just move over a couple of feet and I'm able to hit the repeater quite well then. It may be that somebody has a big barn, a metal barn, 100 feet away, and it hits the barn and comes in, and on that one spot, there's total destructive interference, and the signal totally goes away. But just half a wavelength or maybe a little bit more off of that spot, and you get a constructive interference. You just kind of have to play with it and be aware that it happens. That's the whole thing. You study these things so that you can kind of figure out what's supposed to happen and then look for it. And it helps, especially this Fresnel stuff, because if I'm going to put, maybe I have two hills, the rest is jungle all around these two hills. Can I make a link between those two hills? Well, how much higher than the canopy are the two hills? Are they? Do they have absorption wood, growing wood that has lots of moisture in it? Or are they bald and I could just set up two antennas and I can see it? Is there any kind of a rock in between? You got to think about all these things. And you know, try it. The easiest thing is set it up and try it. But if you've got to buy something and you don't have one side and you can't set it up, then you kind of do all the physics you can and all the formulas you can, get a good estimate, and then go with it. Okay, anybody else? Thank you, Jan. The amount of energy divided by the time during which we measure it is called power. The power is measured in watts and is of key importance for a wireless links to work. You need a certain minimum power in order for a receiver to make sense of the signal. Can't stress this enough. We will come back to details, transmission power, losses, gains, and radio sensitivity in the chapter called Antennas and Transmission Lines. Here we briefly discuss power and how it's defined and measured. The electric field is measured in volts per meter, potential difference per meter. The power contained within it is proportional to the square of the electric field. So the bigger the electric field, the square of the electric field, the more power you have. Practically, we measure the power in watts by means of some form of receiver, i.e. an antenna, and a voltmeter, power meter, oscilloscope, spectrum analyzer, or even a radio card or a laptop, or the view meter on your little handheld. Looking at the signal's power directly means looking at the square of the signal in volts and dividing by the electrical resistance. And so there it talks about dBs. Now, dBs I've always been weak on. I just memorized a long time ago that if you have a gain of 3 dB, you're doubling the signal. And that works for most things, but it's not exactly true. Does anybody want to talk to that?
Well, you have it right there. You go up by a factor of 10, it's 10 dB. A factor of 2 is 3 dB. A factor of 4 is 6 dB. And you can kind of fill in the other values in between there.
There you go. And really, that's what you need to do. There's the formula, and it works. And also, you'll see dBi and dB, what are some of the others? dBz, what's another one?
dBm.
DBM, all of these, well, I'm looking with a little bit different picture. Still, you double the you triple the number of dB, and you've doubled the signal strength, the power that it's putting out.
Contact AB3ZI.
Sure.
So I've gotten quite a bit of practice with decibels over the last year or so, getting into ham radio, and I studied them in, you know, with the math courses before then. So I mean, the way I handle them now, you know, I take that dB figure, divide by 10, and then you raise 10 to that power, which is, you know, the equation that we're looking at here. It's just working in different, you know, algebraically. So, as you know, if I'm looking at figures, like I was looking at some figures on receive sensitivities, and I see a reference to 90 dBm. So that's actually going to be, you know, divide 90 by 10 to get 9, and it's actually a reduction. So now you make that negative, so 10 to the power of negative 9. And, of course, another, you know, that's with reference to millivolts, but or milliwatts, but also with dBs, and this came up with a more experienced ham that I know was actually a young ham, but he's become president of our local club here. You're always talking about a reference, just like with voltage. You know, voltage only has meaning is you as a potential difference. So once again, here you have a ratio, as we see in that equation. So there's always some reference by whether it's an isotropic antenna or a dipole or milliwatts. You know, as some of the examples that we just looked at. And I yield.
Those of you, and I doubt that there are any here that are old enough to remember before we had calculators and computers and all that stuff, we had slide rules, which were just a log conversion device. So you set it a number and you read the log of the number and you multiplied it by 10 and you had the number of dBs for the ratio. It was all very simple and straightforward. And now you have to learn to punch all those numbers into your calculator. Maybe hit the second function, do a few other things, and you have no clue whether it's right or wrong. It just comes out as an answer. Over.
This is true. Okay, so they address dBm relative to P0. So in addition to dimensionless dBs, there are a number of definitions that are based on certain base value of P0, which is the originating power. The most relevant ones for us are dBm relative to a power starting of 1 milliwatt. So dBm means I know my antenna is starting with an output of 1 milliwatt. So whatever you measure now, it's based upon a 1 milliwatt power reference. And then dBi is relative to an ideal isotropic antenna. That just means one is a vertical antenna and it radiates in all directions. Okay, I want to just, another common, less convenient convention for expressing power is in milliwatts. 1 milliwatt, 2 milliwatts, 100 milliwatts, there you go. There's the dB. So it has a link there. I want to give everybody a chance to do that for homework. And then it says physics in the real world. Don't worry if the concepts of this chapter seem challenging. Understanding how radio waves propagate and interact with the environment is a complex field of study in itself. I agree. Most people find it difficult to understand phenomena if they can't see with their own eyes. And now you should always travel only in a straight, predictable path. To make a reliable communication network, you'll need to be able to calculate how much power is needed to cross a given distance and predict how the waves will travel along the way. Well said. And with that, we come to the end of Chapter 1. So anybody wants to finish reading Chapter 1, and then maybe next time we can attack something else. I don't know what the next chapter is. Let's see, telecommunications basics. We can start talking about that. I'm kind of tend towards the antennas and transmission lines, but I'll have to look at it and see if it's worth going. Does anybody have any suggestions of what they'd like to learn for next week?
Well, most of them look interesting.
Okay, I'll take a look, and we'll jump to one of those chapters next week.
Hey, Terry, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Dan Montana. What are you referencing? I haven't been on for a long time.
The wireless networking in developing world. It's in Whiskey November, deltawhiskey.net. And you can use the online book.
And they're on. Can you say that one more time?
Sure. Okay, Whiskey November, deltawhiskey.net.
Thank you.
Okay. And it's just a crash course in physics. I just jumped into it because it looked like it was fun. And it has the it has some illustrations that came in very handy. Instead of describing them with words, I could say, look at page 27 or 15 or whatever it was, and say, that top description, that's kind of what we're talking about. And it makes it a little more clear. And thank you, Dan. Anybody else? Hearing nothing, I'm going to close the net. This is the NLA Hamsnet. It's conducted every Wednesday night at approximately 8 p.m. Eastern Time. We talk about things regarding the NLA and ham radio. We are open to anybody's participation. Anybody wants to can jump in. And you can bring your questions or you can teach a class. Whatever you want to do, please come. We enjoy having everybody and having a little discussion. I'm Terry from Colorado. My call sign is KI0RE, Kilo India Zero, Romeo Echo. And I appreciate everyone's participation tonight. And I say welcome to anybody that's on for the first time or in a long time. And thank you very much. The net is now closed.